quiet.
All right. Let's call to order the meeting of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Welcome, everybody. We've got a long and full agenda, but we do have a quorum here now. Welcome, colleagues. Always nice to see you once every other month.
Nice.
We're going to kick off with, and I will note, we have posted to go until 6 today. So there is a chance we will get done, but we've got an agenda that that may well go until 6. So we're going to begin with Craig and Cheryl and Bob, all dutifully sitting together. Come on forward as we talk about rest areas and travel information experiences.
And facial hair.
Please feel free to begin in whatever order you'd like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Russell, and usually I say I'm with the Oregon Trucking Associations. Today, I'm with the Oregon Travel Experience. And with me is Cheryl Gripsko, our executive director, and Craig Campbell, who is lobbyist for the Oregon Travel Experience. Most of you probably know us as the Travel Information Council, which we were for years. We're the blue sign people. The blue signs on the side of the highway with the logos from the restaurants and motels and gas stations that are located and serve the travelers on the highways. In 2009, as part of House Bill 2001, our role changed. And there were a number of rest areas along the highway that were transferred from the Department of Transportation to the Travel Information Council in recognition that we wanted to go a little different direction with those. So that's why we have changed our name to the Oregon Travel Experience, and we've gone through this rebranding effort because we're no longer the blue sign people. We're the blue sign people and the historical marker people and the heritage tree people and the rest area people. All of those things fall under our bailiwick. And we're here today primarily to talk about rest areas. And when we talked with the travelers, we did a survey of travelers and to find out what they expected in a rest area. And some of the things are very much what you would expect. They wanted to be safe. Some of you have probably heard the stories about the Baldock rest area that we had basically a little town living in the rest area. The school bus stopped there every day, took the children to school. Of course, at night it wasn't quite so nice. So we worked with all of the agencies in Clackamas County, and we relocated those folks, and we no longer have that issue with the rest area, except some of those folks are now our employees, and they're helping keep the rest area clean and up to standard and all of that kind of stuff. So that was a real positive experience. The other thing that the traveler was looking for is cleanliness, and we're keeping the rest areas. I don't know if you've stopped at a rest area recently, but they are all facilities that you don't mind using. Sort of the third thing that they were looking for is something nice, some nice place to stop. And you know, I did a cross-country trip with my son a few years ago, and we went from Atlanta, Georgia, and drove back to Oregon. And we stopped at a lot of rest areas. And I was just amazed. The rest areas in Mississippi were beautiful. They were these antebellum mansions. They were staffed with people full-time. The local folks were doing picnics at the rest areas. I mean, they were obviously part of the community. And I looked at the rest areas here in Oregon, and I wasn't so proud of them. And so, at least from my perspective, there were some things that we could do so as Oregonians we could be proud of what is the first impression often of the travelers coming to our state. But I think the most important thing that we've done with the rest areas is the approach that we have taken to economic development. We have formed coalitions around each of the rest areas, and sort of the idea is we want to point the traveler to the local restaurants, the local motels, and the local attractions around that rest area so that the rest area is part of the economic development of the community. And that approach has been very successful and, quite frankly, has garnered us a lot of support for what we have been doing. And we would like to continue doing it, and we would like to do more of it, which we are going to talk about here in a minute.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Cheryl Grudzko, CEO of the Oregon Travel Experience. And just piggybacking on what Bob is saying, when the bill was being considered in 2009, the one thing that we did feel was a huge opportunity in Oregon was the use of rest areas for economic development. We knew that other states had capitalized and maximized that effort, and we wanted to make it the most successful effort we could. So it's not an easy thing to do in a rest area that's governed by federal policies and state policies, but we did know this, that if we focused on the local area for the majority of the expenditures, that we would be able to employ people that were unemployed, that we'd be able to give businesses more business because they came from Albany to the Sandy M rest area rather than us bidding it out statewide and then having businesses come in that would take that money away from the local area. So we've been very successful and have made it our privilege to make sure that the folk in the local area have the opportunity to work in the rest area in whatever form they're needed. I'm happy to say that 60% of the people that we hired were unemployed and needed to find jobs, and so this has been a real blessing, especially in the rural areas. And that has been the thing we started on January 1, 2010, and we've maintained it and kept going. And today we hired a man from Albany who lost his job at NORPAC, and he will be running the Sandy M rest area, which is 10 minutes away, and working with that local coalition. So you have that symbiotic relationship so that every single thing the coalition wants to do on an economic development standpoint, he'll be right there with them to help support that. So other things that we've done to further that cause is in the North Baldock and South Baldock rest areas, the truck usage, no offense, has rutted the parking lot to the point where it was dangerous to walk in it, and it was really dangerous to drive if you had a small car. Canby Company won the bid, and they repaved that parking lot. We needed to replace cement waste cans that had deteriorated over the years, and a local welder in Donald has provided all the new waste cans that are in the rest areas now. Every single sidewalk, everything we have done to upgrade and improve came from local businesses. So we're sticking to it, and we believe in it with all our hearts. The other thing that we're doing is upgrading the coffee service so that instead of nonprofits coming in trailers and serving coffee and then going away without having any relationship with us, we have offices in each rest area where our supervisors are who are taking care of the traveler and making sure that and there's a lot of stories about what's happened with on-site personnel. But part of those offices have now been retrofitted so that they have coffee people who not only serve the coffee, but local visitor bureaus and chambers of commerce have trained them in how to talk to folk about what's in the local area. So now we have people making money for their nonprofit organization, but also serving the economic development needs of the community. And on the other side of those offices are the state police offices that are going in so that the visitor can feel a lot more safe as they come in late at night because we have OSP officers in there doing their paperwork. Some of the coalitions have made some great strides. One is the Ontario Coalition, who has seen the rest area as being one of their primary targets for their economic development purposes, and so they are working with us on a reader board that will direct people, let people know about the current events, what they ought to know about, and direct people right down to the Ontario Chamber. And that's a partnership with the City of Nyssa and Vail and Ontario. One of the most important things that happened, as you know, this year was the partnership that formed to save government camp so that the skiers had it over the week, or over the weekend, over the winter. And I think one of the most gratifying things about that is the partnership, truly, that developed and the willingness of everybody to give what they had to that effort. So we want to do a shout-out, actually, to Paul Mather from the Department of Transportation, who provided excellent leadership. He is on our council, gets what this is all about, and did a wonderful job of helping us through. And Daniel Cowan, who actually formed a mini coalition up there immediately when the government camp rest area was considered to be in danger, and came to the table with Clackamas County support. And then we are able to donate labor. We have people at Baldock that are able to go up there and do the management and also do the cleaning so that we keep it open and keep it clean while Clackamas County carries the cost of the utilities. It is one of the most amazing partnerships I've seen happen in a long time, so we're very, very proud of that. We also were informed that the National Safety Rest Area Association has adopted the coalition model on a national basis, because rest area managers are finding out that it's a good deal to get people involved with public land and the best use of public land. So we're very proud of that. We want to find a permanent solution to the government camp issue. Starting in January, we have citation authority, so anything that's an administrative rule, our people can write a citation and make sure that we're keeping the traveler even more safe by having on-site folk there that keep things at a level of control with that. And then we're working with the local coalitions and the businesses on finding better ways to disseminate information. So that's where we've been this year, and that's where we're headed. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Travel Experience. I'm going to make my comments fairly brief, but many of the members who are on this committee were involved in the experiment in 2009 with the Jobs and Transportation Act that initially granted the authority of the what was then the Travel Information Council and ODOT to enter into kind of an experimental agreement where we would take on these rest stops, because we had the firm belief that there was a right way to do rest stops, where you really wanted people who were coming into Oregon to be happy where they were going to their rest stops, that they would feel safe and that they would be clean, but not only that, but that there would be an effort to reach out to them there to make them not only feel welcome to Oregon, but to encourage them to visit nearby areas and contribute to the economic development of those areas. It is serendipitous that I think all along there's been a belief that that was just the first step and that Oregon Travel Experience would expand that role and take on additional rest areas as we go forward. It was perfect timing in many ways that the government camp discussion happened when it was, because we were already in discussions about the idea of expanding the number of rest areas that the Oregon Travel Experience would take on. And since government camp was one that that there was, a fairly passionate belief needed to stay open, it is much more in line with the OTE vision than what ODOT has to manage. They're folks who want to focus on making sure people can travel safely, get to where they're going on our roads, and that our roads and transportation systems are well maintained. For us, our passion is around making sure that the traveler in Oregon is well taken care of and we get them where they need to go by directing them there and making them feel welcome. So with that, I would say that we believe we know how to take care of rest areas. It's a role that we enjoy. We're passionate about it. And we go about it in a way that includes local decision makers, local government interests, local business interests, so that they really feel that those rest areas near their communities are their rest areas. And as a result of that, we stand ready to expand our role and would be willing to work with the committee in any way that they seem appropriate and for us to do that. And obviously, we will continue to work with our partners at the local level and with ODOT to make sure that we do that right. We are open to any questions you may have for us.
Questions for Representative Lindsay?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. I'm on your website here looking at it as well. Thanks for all you're doing. Mm-hmm. I guess, therefore, what is my question? What needs do you have? What are you asking for? You have too much money? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, if we're going to expand the number of rest areas that OTE takes on, there will be a cost associated with that. It is more than the existing cost of taking care of the rest areas because we do it in a different way. We are much more robust in the services we provide in the rest areas than is traditionally the case in the state of Oregon. So that would certainly be the case. It would. And obviously, up till now, those monies have come from the transportation fund, and we make sure that we stay within the limits of what the transportation fund can be used for. We're not asking for anything outside of that because we believe that part of what we bring to the table is the ability to bring local government and local economic interests to the table to try and take care of those other things we'd like to do for economic development outside of the highway fund. But it would really, we would need to take some we would need some legislative authority to expand the role of the number of rest areas that we would manage. In addition to that, I will comment that the Oregon Travel Experience, their initial statute is essentially still in place as it was when it was created in 1972 as a result of the Lady Bird Johnson Act. Much has changed since 1972, including much of the paranoia that was that arose around the time that that was drafted. So many of the members that are on our commission really were designed to prevent us from doing things like taking over the role of doing neon signs in area cities, which has never been something we've done, but those are very old. So really what we need to do is we need to look about expanding some of the authority that the Oregon Travel Experience has by way of having an economic development focus and things like that, so that when we're dealing with our local partners at the rest areas, we're better to do that with the proper authority from you, the policymakers, not just kind of operating on our own in that capacity.
Other questions? Mr. Kocher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, if the local community is going to benefit, as Ontario has, is there an effort to prompt those folks to invest? Because the Visitors and Convention Bureau would be the obvious source of additional funds. Have you gone to those folks and said, hey, if we're going to clean this situation up and make it better for you, maybe you should invest part of your money in that effort? And is that a part of what you're looking forward to doing as a, shall we say, a prompt for us to look at more funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, conversations are actually going around about how the coalitions are able to accomplish what they need to do in an economic development manner that can't be covered by highway fund limitations. So the reader board that we're talking about in Ontario is going to be a partnership of a lot of different venues in there so that we're all bringing money to the table to put that out there. But they have donated and invested lots of labor and lots of money in special gardens that they felt needed to be there. And also we have partnered on that Welcome to Oregon sign that just went in. So the conversations are happening at that level right now because that's where they want to go. It may be that later on that kind of support would be at the table.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is if the Travel Experience Group is going to be looking for, is going to be utilizing economic development as a reason for spending more money on these things, we need to see who's directly benefited and make sure that those folks who are directly benefited are helping carry the freight. And so okay. I just want to make sure that that's actually happening in your discussion.
Okay. Yes, it is. Thank you.
Let me also drill down a little bit in terms of government camp. You specifically talked about finding a February solution. Mm-hmm. Can you just maybe hit on, as you've looked at the dynamics there, looked at the funding you have, looked at kind of all the dynamics, any specific thoughts at this point in terms of what you see as the optimal action in February mm-hmm. to make sure that that stays open?
Mm-hmm. We've developed a budget which I don't have with me, but what we did was take a look at what needs to be done there, but also what we can bring to the table that's already being paid for mm-hmm. by us. So we'll be bringing in management that won't be part of any kind of an ask in 2012. So really the bottom line is that probably that we will need one janitorial person and then the cost of the utilities. And then we're talking partnerships with some of the local businesses about any kind of other offerings. And we're also talking about some grant funding for some enhancements that could happen.
Mr. Chair, the other thing I'd comment on, to find a permanent solution, as I'd mentioned before, we were already contemplating the idea of asking for additional rest areas to take on, and Government Camp would certainly work in that very easily, and I think the urgency is to make sure that that's taken care of, mm-hmm. Because the alternative for Government Camp on March 1st is that it would shut down if we don't have a solution for it. So I think I speak for OT pretty clearly in saying that we would be very happy to work with you as a committee to come up with what the items for that sort of a solution would be, so that however you want to deal with it during the legislative session, we stand ready to do that.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's definitely strong interest. I know for Representative Sheehan's constituents and for mine, and certainly for Representative Thompson and even Representative Huffman, kind of the other side of the mountain. It's just a pretty significant issue, and probably a fairly unique issue, because I can't think of another part of Oregon where you've got such isolation in between, isolation from services in between kind of two mm-hmm. distant population centers. So I think there definitely is a strong interest, and yet I think the flip side is, and Representative Benson and I have talked about this, not wanting to do it in a way that robs Peter to pay Paul in terms of causing other problems in terms of all the infrastructure needs that we have out there. So yeah, it would be great if you could give us the draft budget you've got. That'd be a
yes.
great additional piece of information.
And we need to continue conversations too with both ODOT, and we're talking to local governments. So we're trying to come up with some good solutions that everybody can live with.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Appreciate being here. Let's move on to.
It's start clapping.
No clapping required. Let's move on to Sana, Peter, and Cam. Has Cam arrived yet?
Yeah,
okay. Great. We're moving into, you'll see our next two items, colleagues are really focusing on exercising oversight of investments that we as a legislature have passed, seeing how those investments have gone in this first segment in terms of higher ed infrastructure investments.
Yes.
And then the second component, looking at transportation investments we've made and really seeing how they've gone, what kind of bang for the buck we're getting, and what kind of long-term return on investment we can expect to see. So we appreciate you all being here to guide us in that conversation. Feel free to jump in whatever order you'd like.
Thank you. Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Hunt, and members of the committee, I'm Sana Andrews, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Academic Strategies with the Oregon University System. And pleased to be here today to talk about how OUS is making sure that its academic programs are meeting the workforce needs of the state of Oregon. First of all, our board has four mm-hmm. goals, and only four goals, and in each one of those goals, there's information embedded in there on how our academic programs need to provide access and how they need to stimulate the economy and citizenry of Oregon. We've been going through a pretty extensive process over the last year in what we're calling mission alignment, where each of our institutions has identified its mission in terms of the regions that it serves, so this slide shows access, in terms of the academic programs that they have an intensity in, and in terms of where they're contributing to innovation and research. And in fact, in this document about mission alignment, what it says is that economic development is then represented in each one of these charts that I just showed you. We have a very rigorous process that we use in order to approve programs. This is just an example of the approval process for our professional Masters of Science programs. We have a similar process for baccalaureate degrees and other master's degrees and doctoral degrees. But it starts at the institutional level with processes they have there, which include a business plan and a needs assessment. Then it goes through the Provost Council at OUS and the Chancellor's Office. Our programs have an external review, and then they go to ODA for an adverse impact, and then to our State Board of Higher Education for approval. We do a lot of assessment of our programs in terms of looking at every single program and having those assessments informed by employees and employers at every step of the way. So for every academic program we have, we ask the questions, what do we want students to learn? How do we know they're learning it? And then what needs to change in the curriculum to make sure that we keep current and make sure that the students are learning what needs to be learned so that they will be successful in the workplace. We also have a system-wide learning outcomes and assessment committee that ensures that all of our academic programs do follow these steps that I just laid out for you. All of our institutions have career services resources that help students not only identify a major, but also help them with job placement, have career fairs, and work with the local community in terms of what employers will need. You've been provided a list, it's about a page and a half, of just an example of some of the programs that we've added at OUS that specifically target workforce needs. On this slide, I just have a couple of them, but every single one of our institutions over the course of the last 3 years have done assessments in their local areas and statewide, have determined what some of the needs are, and have developed academic programs specifically designed to address those. We have a lot of links to business and industry. You're all pretty familiar, I'm sure, with ETIC, but we also have lots of students who are doing internships. We had 11,000 students last year do an internship, and in some cases, some of those students did two internships. But 11,000 individual students. We have students engaged in service learning courses. Many of our programs have business and industry advisory boards. In fact, I don't know, some of you may sit on those. And then we have discipline-based student clubs. And the reason I mention that is that sometimes clubs are trivialized, but it's a great way for students to be able to interact with people in business and industry because oftentimes those individuals serve as advisors for those clubs. And then we also, in the past, had done an employer survey. We stopped doing that a couple of years ago due to budget reasons. But we are going to start it up again this year. And what we're going to be doing is we're going to be doing a survey in 2012. And each year we will focus on a particular business sector. Our target for this coming year will be focusing on the areas around software engineering, engineering, civil engineering, math, and science, so mostly focused on the STEM areas. We are thinking that that will give us some better results than just sending out something to a lot of employers and asking some general questions. I did want to give you a sense of the return on investment and the direct impact that our efforts have on students, and I'll only give you just a few samples here. But OIT got a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy for $2.5 million. And what it was designed to do is expand their capacity in renewable energy. The grant helped support 5 new faculty members, and there are quite a few students in the program. So a program specifically targeted to meet workforce needs. And then what I wanted to do is just talk a little bit about how our institutions are making an effort to retain students, because one of the goals is educational attainment so that these students will get their degrees and go out into the workplace. And this is just an example of what Eastern Oregon University is doing. And down at the bottom of the slide, you can see that based on those efforts, they saw a dramatic increase over the last 2 years in the retention of students. The more students we retain, the more likely they are to graduate, the more likely they are to then go out and be productive in the workplace. And then the Oregon State University, I gave some examples from here. And again, showing how these efforts have increased student retention and thus student attainment toward graduation. So just in summary, we've got a very rigorous process for program approval. We've aligned the missions of all of our institutions in order to be able to look at access and workforce needs within each region of Oregon. All of our programs have learning outcome assessment. We provide a lot of career services to our students. We've developed quite a few programs that are targeted toward the workforce needs of both regions and the state. We have good linkages between business and industry. We're constantly looking at the ROI, making sure that we are getting a good return on investment. And what I didn't include in my presentation, because I know you are only going to go till 6 o'clock, is to talk about the contributions of research, public service, our experimental stations, and many other things that we do in OUS that contribute to economic development. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are we waiting until the panel's done? Or?
Yeah, why don't we wait until all three of them are done? That'd be great. Cam, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Cam Preuss. I'm the Commissioner of Community Colleges. Co-chairs Hunt and Bentz, you have, I'm not displaying a PowerPoint. I just made a couple of handouts. It's going to sound familiar. Because not surprisingly, we have some of the very same processes in place to ensure the public trust of the funds goes to train individuals where there are or is occupational need. The first page of the handout that I have provided provides you our process for approval at the state level. For those of you who may be unfamiliar, the State Board of Education has responsibility for program approval for community college programs. And you can see there are five criteria that each college and each program within the college must meet. My colleague, Peter Angstead, will talk to you about the process that happens at the college levels. Again, it's in parallel to the university system where there is a process at the local institutional level before it ever comes to the department. Once the department has reviewed for this set of criteria, then the state board does have the approval of all programs. The next slide is just an example of some of the career and technical programs that are currently operating. I also provided you with a handout that looks like this. And this is this is called the View Book. It's on our website. It's also on all the institution websites, but it's a quick way to look at which college offers which degree or certificate and in what program areas. Am I ahead of you? Or am I okay? All right. The next slide is just a look at the top 22 high wage, high demand jobs, just to remind you of what those are. The next slide, slide number 4, gives you a snapshot of those same occupations that are in demand and the community college awards for the last year for which we have full audited data, which is 9-10. And there you can see by the red bar, that's the demand, and the blue bar is the number of awards. And some look like they are almost in balance, but certainly nursing remains the one that we currently have the greatest shortage. The next slide, slide number 5, is the a snapshot of the percent of community college career and technical completers who are working after graduation. And this is, again, by a particular type of occupation. And you can see it does move around a little bit. Some of that has to do, of course, with the economy, not just the preparation. But from a cost-benefit impact study that we had done, the last one we did was in 2006. There was discussion about doing it in 2010, but we decided that we couldn't afford it. So I have to lean on that 2006 data. But in that particular study, it indicated that 93% of Oregon Community College students who graduate with a career in technical degree or certificate stay in their community. The next slide, because I was pretty sure I heard some interest in knowing about return on investment as far as our key performance measures were concerned. This is a slide that I just lifted from our Ways and Means presentation from the last legislative session. And I have taken to using these arrows to quickly indicate our performance. And the last cell is what our overall target was for 2009. And you can see the red bars say we're not going in the right direction. Green, we're doing fine. Blue, we're really close to the tipping point of going over or under in our performance. And page 7 is a continuing, but it's a further drill down into training programs that likely are some of the most expensive that the community college operate. And you can see there the passage rate of nursing and other completion licensing and credentials. And last but not least is a slide around student persistence and completion. What you just saw in our key performance measure would say to me, and does say to me, and probably to you, that there is more work to be done to make sure that when students start, they actually persist and finish. And so this last slide is a snapshot of the work that we are doing in four very particular and distinct areas, again, much aligned with our university colleagues, to ensure that when students start, they have supports, and the support is based on empirical evidence that either from national models or other states who have done work to ensure that students are successful as they progress through it to completion. And I could spend time on that, but again, you probably have other things you'd like to discuss, and I'd like for President Angstad to be able to talk to you about how it works at Rogue Community College.
Great. Thank you. Thanks. Welcome.
Co-Chair Hunt and Bentz and members of the committee, I'm Peter Angstad. I'm president of Rogue Community College. And as Cam was pointing out, I want to talk a little bit about the specific success of the students in community colleges. As Kim also mentioned, we determine the workforce needs by talking to the employers, by looking at the data that's out there, and also looking at the student demand and future demand, what future trends are. But you can see, I'll specifically reference this chart, these series of charts I have called Creating New Taxpayers. And where we came up with that title was last election season. There was a lot of comment about we didn't need new taxes, we needed new taxpayers. And so we thought, well, we're out there creating those new taxpayers. So let's see how much in terms of payrolls that we've created. And this is the data that I've gathered thus far, but it is not all inclusive. And you can see there we have our graduates and our manufacturing on the front page. And I guess I would also like to point out is the salaries that they're receiving is really proportional to the length of time they've spent in the programs. For example, you can get out of a program after a one-year certificate, or in some programs, a shorter certificate or a shorter program than that, or you can go through and get the two-year degree. And so what we find is the people that do receive the additional training are rewarded at the end by their employers who give them the higher salaries. So you can see there we have manufacturing, we have electronics, we have our dental assisting program. We have our apprenticeship program, which is some of our higher paid completers. But I'd also like to point out our occupational skills training. In this case, these are people who this is their first experience in the workforce, and these are a series of very focused courses that we work with specific employers, and we match up the student and the employer and the specific courses the employer needs. When that student has completed that specific number of courses, they're hired. And what's nice about this is it gets the student a job and also gives the student their first taste of the educational process, which in most cases leads them to continue on to achieve either a specific certificate or a degree. And then at the end there, we just have kind of some additional students who did receive certificates or degrees. And then the total combined annual income, and again, this is all the data I have right now, and it's not all inclusive, but we estimated that last year we produced $5.9 million with the private industry community, $5.9 million in private industry, and in some cases public industry payrolls, and created $5.9 million in new taxpayers. And I would probably estimate that if we could gather this data for all the community colleges, we would have probably have produced last year about $500 million in new payrolls and new taxpayers. So in terms of a return on investment as a taxpayer in Oregon, I'd say this is pretty wonderful return on investment, and something that we're going to continue to grow and expand the program needs of our employers in Oregon, and see what we can do to create even more taxpayers.
Thank you. Questions?
So, I had a couple, if that's okay. Thank you, President. My question was, so for the manufacturing careers or the dental assistant graduates, how much does it cost them to get through that?
Representative Hunt, Representative Bentz, and Representative Lindsay, it really all depends on the specific program. For example, the manufacturing program is just based on the regular tuition, and in which case would probably run you about $3,000 to get through that program, depending upon what certificate you were after. Dental assisting is a very specialized program with some very specialized equipment requirements. It's a little bit more expensive. It's a basically 12-month continual program, and again, that would probably run you about probably $3,000 to $5,000 to get through that program.
Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair. A comment, actually, that's interesting because it's more expertise, but wage per hour is less than in manufacturing. I guess that's just a comment on society there.
It's demand.
Yeah. The second thing was, Ms. Andrews, was you said that $2.5 million from the Department of Energy, there was a grant of $2.5 million. that went to renewable energy, which gave five faculty at a university to help meet workforce demand. I guess this is a two-part question is where is that workforce need? Where graduates, I guess, that came out of that program, where did they go? That's number one. And then number two is, besides the five faculty jobs that the $2.5 million created, what other innovative ideas or jobs or industry came out of that? I guess that, and just so you know where I'm going with these, those two questions are, a lot of graduates out there don't have jobs. If we're meeting workforce demand, where's the demand? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
So, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Lindsay, and members of the committee, let me just put this in a broader context, and that is that as the business plan was developed for this particular program, there was a look at what the needs are in terms of renewable energy. And it was one of these things where we haven't produced any graduates yet. The program's fairly new. Those graduates will be graduating in the next couple of years. And we do think that there is a demand in the state, statewide. This is not just in Southern Oregon, but statewide in this particular area. We are always careful to make sure that we don't produce too many graduates. So the capacity of the program is based on two things. One is the number of graduates that we think we should be producing so we don't overproduce, and then the revenue that we have or the funding that we have in order to be able to do that. The five faculty not only contribute in terms of educating students, but also contribute in terms of research. And all of our faculty, even at our comprehensive institutions, are involved in scholarly activity. So it's not only the jobs that they will create, but it's the technology they will create that also then will create jobs and new ways of doing things.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
One more.
So you said that there will be demand. Where do you think that would be?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Lindsay, members of the committee, I don't have that information in front of me, but I do, there was a very detailed business plan that was put together for this. I just can't recall what region of the state or where in the state that is.
Thank you.
Representative Lindsay. I'm sorry, Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
He's not tall enough.
Professor. Yeah, not tall enough at all.
Yeah, right.
This information is awesome, having just a list of the top biggest things. And I was on the Clackamas Community College, some sort of board like 10 years ago that did stuff like this. I would have liked to have information this specific. One of the frustrations I had then was that what little information we had, we weren't turning that into anything. So I'd be curious as to what you're doing with this information to get this in the hands of students and to tell them when they get there, you need to be a nurse or an electrician.
Co-Chairs Hunt and Vincent. Should I call you Representative Lindsay?
Actually, the employment department, which produces a lot of this information, provides both an online and a catalog that you can put your hands on that's distributed to all high school students and is in all community colleges and I dare say other alternative schools and places like that. So the information and that brochure is called Careers. And it points out and lays out for a student what the expectation is as far as demand for the job, wages for the job, the expectation of what kind of working conditions, wages, and where you can go to get the training, both public and private. So that is available, and it's pretty much permeated, I think, high schools and community colleges and workforce centers, as well as having that information online. Additionally, there are advisors and counselors that are available at a community college workforce center or high school that can help students direct them, but ultimately it is their choice about where they pursue their education But we do try to put in front of them the information about where the demand jobs are so that they can be gainfully employed when they finish their education.
I have a question related. So I look at the nurse gap, let's call it, and also sort of the bookkeeper gap. Is that unmet need potentially met by your world, or is that already being filled by other ways to become registered nurse rather than coming to you? And what do we, if anything, do to, other than sort of counseling students, or in addition to that, to address some of that unmet need?
Co-chairs Hunt, Bence, and Representative Smith, it's an interesting question, particularly around nursing. We have collectively, between public and private post-secondary education over the last 5 years, really ramped up and probably doubled our capacity in registered nursing and bachelor's degree nursing by reorienting the curriculum, by working with the industry, the healthcare industry, to ensure that we streamline the applied part of the registered nurse and bachelor's nurse so that the on-site practical experience is well aligned. And we share faculty across the system, both across community colleges and the university, and there's still not enough capacity to serve every individual who wants to be a nurse. Every community college has a lottery program of some kind that chooses the top 50 students, and they may have, personally know that Lynn Benton Community College had over 200 qualified students, and they took 50. So we have capacity issues at the industry for the practicum, with capacity issues in faculty. What we don't lack are students who want to be nurses. We've sort of gotten over that hump, but the ability to serve all of them with the capacity that we have, given the rules around how nursing education happens, just keeps us from making even greater gains in this particular occupation.
Representative Smith, follow up.
Yeah, please. Thanks. So I think what I heard you say is there aren't plenty of students, and there's plenty of people to hire them. There aren't enough teachers, and there are not enough places for them to apprentice, or not enough places for them to practice. It begs a question of what are we doing about that, right? It just sort of seems like obvious market or governmental failure, and not personal failure. I mean, in terms of the economic terms, I blame you is what I'm telling you. You've really done a bad thing, and wondering if there's anything in addition that we're doing with that. I heard collaboration. That sounds good. And then I have one other unrelated question. When you're done with that,
co-chairs Hunt, Bence, and Representative Smith, there are things that we're doing. There's a scholarship program, and at the moment I'm blanking on exactly who manages it. I think it might be the Scholarship Commission, but that provides scholarships for nurses who want to go back and be nursing instructors. It is in the pay to be a nursing instructor is not competitive with the pay to be a nurse in the industry. So part of the mismatch is getting nurses who are retiring out of the field to come back and be nurse instructors. And so we're doing that. We're also providing what we believe are incentives for students to have a master's in order to be an instructor. So sometimes that bachelor's nurse has to come back to gain their master's in order to be an instructor. So there's an investment of time on the individual's part. But it's a complex dilemma, and we are, I think, moving on it in as many fronts as we can with the resources that we have.
Last question?
Last call.
On another topic, tell me or tell us what we're doing or what more can be done in sort of kind of new collaborative learning models. One near my house is the ACE Schools, where I think is a collaboration of the public school district, community colleges, private sector, et cetera, to create sort of technical education centers, and, you know, where I can go and learn how to drive a front loader without actually having to drive a front loader, which is bad to do for the first, like, 10 times. So talk to me about what we're doing about that.
Co-chairs Hunt and Benson, Representative Smith, there are, I would agree with you that the ACE model is terrific, and there aren't very many of them around the state, because they take that special collaboration. They also take some resources in order to bring those things together. But there are, and I would imagine that President Angstead could speak to you about career and technical programs that start in the high school that allow the student then to seamlessly transition to the college, bringing credit with them so that less time is spent, less tuition dollars are spent, and the student moves more quickly into the labor force. But there, quite frankly, aren't very many of those that are still active. Each decade, or perhaps each biennium, we see fewer of them than we did the biennium before, because they are expensive to maintain.
Thanks.
Representative White.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, actually going back on Representative Smith, you have 616, well, I'll stay with the nurses, you could use any one of these, but I just want to know, that's what you're graduating out of the community colleges, correct?
Correct.
Now, what would the total be if we were to put in the private schools and state schools as well? Because I know, like, Linfield has a nursing program. There's lots of private schools with nursing programs as well. And where we're at with those numbers, do we go past that 1272? Or do you have any idea what those numbers would be?
Co-chairs Hunt and Benson, Representative Widener, I can get you that information. We have an institute, a research institute, that's a public-private partnership called the Oregon Workforce Healthcare Workforce Institute, and it is a third party that gathers that kind of information and likely has the private sector and four-year institution numbers. I'm going to hazard a guess that it doesn't make up the other half of this particular bar chart.
If I may follow up, please. That would probably be useful information for us a little bit, because that way we can see where we truly are short and where we truly have too many people. And I do have a niece who has a degree from University of Portland, I think, for nursing. So, and know quite a few people that have got into it. So, mm-hmm.
Does she have a job?
Yeah, she got a job.
I bet she has a job. Thank you.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I'd like to shift gears and talk about something that was raised in a presentation from the Oregon University System. One of the slides that you showed us included information about how many students are involved in internships. It was a big number. Mm-hmm. A whole lot of time is being spent by these students. What I think we know less about, and what I think Oregonians generally are unaware of, is the value of those internships to communities, to businesses, the private sector, and also nonprofit organizations. There's a tremendous amount of work that the interns are accomplishing. Some of it might be described as make work, but I certainly don't. I've seen a lot of valuable work and effort that wouldn't have been done otherwise if it weren't for those programs. So what does the university system do to help Oregonians more generally understand what value you're adding to the state as a result of helping the businesses and nonprofit organizations?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benson, Representative Nathanson, and members of the committee, let me just, before I even answer your question, in addition to the internships, we have thousands of students who are doing service learning, where it's a component, a required component of their course, where they go out into the community and work on projects. We also have a lot of other courses where students are doing community-based work, so I couldn't agree with you more that it has tremendous value. One of the ways that we're really trying to do this is to work with our business and industry partners to be able to create these relationships. These are members of our community, and to be able to get them to realize that our students will provide something valuable. Service learning has been a really good vehicle for that, because there are many nonprofit groups, many small businesses or community agencies that typically can't afford an intern or can't use an intern for an entire quarter, but do have a particular project. So I think, to answer your question again, part of it is us being able to link with those, and our career centers are one of the ways in which we do that. We also make it very, very public what students are doing in their internships and their service learning. But if you have any suggestions for how we can do more of it, we'd appreciate it.
Brief follow-up.
Please.
Sometimes I'm dismayed when you see what's covered in news, whether it's print or broadcast or online. There's a lot of news about bad stuff that happens or the latest scandal. And I've just seen so many terrific projects that are being accomplished. And part of it is, you know, just what are people interested in hearing about. But some of it is, I've seen, like media advisories or press releases sent out. It's too bad that more of them aren't eventually used so that people could find out about this. I just sort of stumbled on a project that had been accomplished by some U of O students working here in Salem on doing some very specific traffic analysis and generating options and analyzing, you know, if you convert this street to one-way or two-way, and if you allow parking here, and what happens to the timing for buses and pedestrians. This was really important work that was done in Salem, but again, it was through a university-arranged program.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very interesting presentation. There's a part of this, though, that I wasn't quite sure how to frame what it is I would like to hear, so I'll just blurt it out, and you guys can try to make sense of it. The idea for today's presentation was to understand the return on the investment the state and the student makes in the educational system. And, of course, we've heard a lot about return, but we haven't heard much about the cost. It's been mentioned a couple of times, it gets pretty involved pretty fast, but there's a lot of money dumped into our systems, a lot, at different levels. The students put some in, the state puts some in, grants and this and that, a whole bunch of value put in. We haven't heard about that today, so I can't really see the return on the investment, if you follow my drift. I've been seeing the return, but I haven't been seeing the investment. So I can't compare the two. What I saw on the presentations was a lot of good things, and I like those, but I have no idea what they cost. And more to the point, I don't know how we would go into that pile of cost and figure out where we're spending too little or too much, or maybe some of what Representative Nathanson just mentioned is adding a whole bunch to what the students are getting, but we're not even taking into account, if you follow me. And so what I was hoping I would see today, I see half of it, and now, am I missing something? Because what I see is a whole bunch of kids camped out under trees and in tents and stuff saying, hey, we're not getting much of a return on our investment. And I wonder how much I hear a lot about, gee, we got hundreds of thousands of student debt, and we're not getting anything back for it. Okay, well, we can talk about that, but that, I really want to, you can understand what I'm asking for. Now, am I overlooking something? Is it just something we don't talk about, how much we invest? What I was hoping to see was the dollar, a pie chart, where the money was coming from, and taking into account all of these things, all these inputs, including the kid who is asked to teach the class by the professor goes and does a research project. I would like to see that value. So if you follow me, that's a pretty big pie chart. And we have about 3 minutes to answer it. Or less.
Mr. Chair, if I may help him out just
sure.
for a little bit.
Representative Wedder.
Most of the ones that are camping in the tents, they went to the colleges that were too much money. These are community colleges, and they would have got a much better return on their investment and got a job, as you can see from here, rather than going to Harvard.
So. Oh, I think you're talking about Enfield. Is that what you're talking about? No. Do you want to respond to that at all, or do you want to think about it and follow up in writing afterward, whatever your preference is?
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Bentz, and the members of the committee, we do look very closely, obviously, at where all the resources come. And for each of our institutions, we do break the budget down as to what we're spending in instruction, what we're spending in research, what we're spending on facilities. So we can certainly provide that information for you. The other thing that we do is we benchmark ourselves against national data for program costs. So we have a sense, for example, what the average cost in the United States is in order to deliver a particular degree. Let's say it's a material science degree. And we look at how effective our institutions are at being able to then produce those degrees. We then are able to look at the contributions that students make, although we have the same problem that our community college partners do, and that is that this state doesn't have to date a database that allows us to track where every single graduate goes and what job they get. So that's the way I can answer it the best, and that is the dollars flowing into our institutions is less than the dollars that flow from our students being able to get jobs.
I could hopefully make a very simplistic and very focused response just for Rogue Community College, Representative Bentz, members of the committee. When you look at the data that we've collected so far, $5.9 million in return, the investment, and that, as I said, I think is about 50% of what we will eventually collect. The data will show on a year-to-year basis. So I'm guessing the return will be over $10 million. Now, the investment that the state provides for us is about $5.2 million. So for $5.2 million, you're getting over $10 million in return on your investment. That's very simplistic, of course.
Can I ask you, probably all three of you, to zero in on one particular piece of the budgetary pie, the capital side, and maybe take a look back and a look ahead to the degree you can. If you think about, because it's one of the areas that we as a state have made a significant investment, probably on an ongoing basis on the university system, and at least in 2005, 7, and 9, in a significant way in the community college system. Can you talk about how you see those dollars, looking back, already having benefited workforce development, job preparation, the kind of connections that you've been talking about on the academic side, and then as you look ahead, how you see the capital side of the ledger being critical to or less than critical to those connections going forward?
I'll start. Co-chairs Hunt and Benson, members of the committee, we had a little heads up that you might ask the question about capital construction, so you should have some materials in front of you. This is the request that came from community colleges to the 2011 legislative session. Just to remind you, community colleges received no capital in the 2011 session. Let me back up just a little bit and talk about the process that we use. We ask each community college, and all community colleges are required to have a master plan about their infrastructure. Then we ask for their top three projects that they believe meet a set of criteria, and that criteria is actually in state administrative rule, and a piece of it is in state statute. And what we use a blind rating system. So we take what the colleges have sent us for their first set of priorities and their second set of priorities, and we rank them and then compile the list. And that's how the list that you have in front of you comes to you, through that blind process. We do have a set of criteria, and we have a set of ranking criteria. And I think it's of note that when we first started this process back in 2005, we didn't, because it had been 25 years since community college had received any support from the state, we stole the due diligence process from the university system because we had none. We really didn't know where to begin. So we used their process to begin our process. And for community colleges, it's a 50-50 match. Colleges have to come up with their own resources. We were originally one of the top ranking criteria is the need in the region for workforce or economic development programs. So the first two rounds of capital construction we had, not surprising, had a lot of health science and other laboratory or career and technical program construction of buildings. And they, not surprisingly because of our criteria, floated to the top, and much of the $240 million that has now been dedicated to community college construction is, I would say, the majority share is around career and technical programs. So that's how we get to that. Now, we did not tell the college what program or what project they should bring or not bring, but when they read the criteria, they could make their own judgment about what we believed was in the state's interest to make sure that we were building the capacity that we thought we needed. And I do think that to the earlier set of questions about nursing and other allied health professions, had we not built that capacity, we would not have been able to really diminish the shortage. We still have a shortage, but it's far less around our own capacity to have the most up-to-date equipment and space for that instruction to occur. And I hope I have come close to answering your question. Yeah.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Benz, and members of the committee. Well, Cam did a nice job in explaining our process, so I don't need to do that. And what do they say? Mimicking is the best form of flattery.
That's
or whatever.
Exactly.
So,
right.
But what I can say is that capital projects are vital to our ability to offer state-of-the-art programs. Most of the money for our capital projects does not come from the state. It's through other sources. But we're always grateful for whatever we do get. Going forward, I will just talk about that. All of our capital projects will be linked to how we will help achieve the 40-40-20 goals that the state has outlined. So as we begin to look at these targeted degree programs and educational attainment, we will be linking those projects to that. But there is absolutely no question that facilities, both buildings and the infrastructure in those buildings, is vital. We can't possibly be training individuals to meet the current and future needs if we don't have the technology and the space in order to do that. So I would say to the question you asked, that it restricts us quite a bit in not having that capacity.
Thank you all. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
I see no other questions.
You.
Thanks for taking the time. We will move on to the transportation side of the investment ledger. Matt, Jerry, and the Pauls.
That's the next one down. Okay. Sorry about that.
Momentarily.
You're still blurry. During the lights.
So.
It's that I can't find any networks. I just opened a message in.
All right, I see pictures of building stuff. I like it already.
It says I'm not on my end.
Let me check. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I just wanted to start out by giving you just a quick update on a few projects.
We can go ahead and have. I think Paul and Jerry can go ahead and come forward as well, and we'll just. You all know which order you're going in, so we got four chairs up there.
My testimony over there. Thanks.
Welcome. Please proceed.
Good. Good. So I just want to give you a quick update on projects. Following this, you're going to see a presentation with Director Garrett and I, and we're going to be about funding. But this, in using this slide, but this slide also depicts to you the various programs that I'm going to be talking about, and just giving you a quick update on the OTEA projects, the Connect Oregon, the ARRA, the federal stimulus dollars, as well as the JTA funds. So I want to start out first with just the Jobs and Transportation Act, the House Bill 2001 that passed in 2009, and just give you a brief update on where we are with those projects. As you know, in Section 64 of that bill, there was 37 projects that were specifically identified, and then there was 12 additional projects with local governments in Eastern Oregon that were later identified for that funding. As we track those various projects, we always track back to those number of 37, but you will see us divide those out and phase those in different ways as we try to get projects to contract as soon as possible and get jobs out on the road. So in the sheet that's being handed out to you in the list of our projects, some of those have been divided up into sub-projects. As you look on our website that we have, it's also a link in my testimony, you will also see, again, kind of those divided back out as we try to get things to contract as soon as possible. In total, we've completed 6 projects so far to date. We have 13 that are under construction and 39 that remain in design or in the environmental process. One of the things I also wanted to point out with the Jobs and Transportation Act is we're still very early on in getting these projects out. And so this chart depicts to you the number of projects and then the volume of contracts. And so while you'll see in the first years we have a relatively high number of projects, the dollar amounts are relatively low, and that's to be expected. They're the simpler projects that we can get out to contract sooner. But starting in the spring of 2013, you'll see the larger projects start to be let to bid for contracts. So we're about a year and a half away from really the larger projects to start to come online. I wanted to walk through with you 3 projects that we're working on just to kind of highlight the work that's going on. Many of you, I know, drive through the I-5, I-205 area and have been this summer to watch this project under construction. This project is an $11 million project to add an additional lane between the North Wilsonville exit and I-205, or what we call an auxiliary lane. This area handles about 100,000 vehicles per day. The good news is we hope, inviting any more curveballs that get thrown at us in the last week or so, but are planning to have this lane open by Thanksgiving next week. As you know, Thanksgiving Wednesday is our busiest travel day of the year anywhere on the highway system, and we're hoping to have this lane open by then. If we don't quite make it, it'll be the following week we'll have it open. The prime contractor on this project is Kerr Contractors of Woodburn. We've also had many local subcontractors from the area, Wilsonville, Aurora, Hillsboro, Forest Grove, the towns around the area, that have benefited from being subcontractors on this particular project. As you've seen this picture, and as you know, driving through, much the work was done at night, just from a logistics standpoint and keeping that volume of traffic moving through this area. But it's going to be a key improvement to complement the lane we built a year earlier in the southbound lane, using the ARRA, the stimulus funds that were used for that lane. The next project I just wanted to quickly highlight is the Sutherland Climbing Lane. This is in Southern Oregon on I-5, just north of the town of Sutherland, where we're adding an additional climbing lane to I-5. As you travel through Southern Oregon and you go up and down the many hills, you'll notice the slower trucks impede the traffic in the right lane, and there's actually quite a significant safety concern as trucks are traveling at a very low speed and then very high speeds in the lane right next to them, and lane shifts that happen. We have accidents and actually fatalities that happen as a result of that. And so this is a capacity improvement as well as a great safety improvement. One of the things we did on this project was we were able to combine this project with a paving project we already had planned in the area, and so we gained some efficiencies in combining those two together into one project. That, along with favorable bids, we not only were able to construct a southbound lane, but we were able to also add to the project and construct the southbound climbing lane in this location as well. The contractor in this project is Tidewater of Brookings, and again, there was a number of local contractors from the area, local trucking firms, that have benefited greatly from this contract. The last project I'm going to highlight is Pierce Road Improvement in Union County. This is in the LeGrand area. This project upgrades a county road and provides better access to an industrial park, the airport, and I-84 through the area. This is a photograph of a section of the road and what it looked like before the improvements. As you can see, it's a typical county road that's not up to standards to handle a heavy truckload or a significant amount of truck traffic. This is a picture of a different section of the road, but shows you the improvement. While it may not look like much compared to many of our freeway projects, for this particular area and for the county, it was a great improvement that should help attract jobs to the industrial area and to the airport. This project was designed by Anderson Perry and Associates, a LeGrand design firm. The prime contractor on this project was High Desert Aggregate and Paving, based in Terrebonne. So just a quick highlights on the JTA projects that we're moving forward with. Just touching quickly on the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or the ARRA funds that came from the federal government. We had approximately $500 million in total came to the state of Oregon. To date, we have spent almost 91% of those dollars. They've all been obligated. We're one of the first states to get all our funds obligated, but we're well on the road to getting all those projects completed as well. Just quickly, with the OTEA program, the OTEA 3, the bridge component of the OTEA 3 bridge program, as I've testified here before, we're rapidly wrapping that program up. It was a program that was passed in the 2003 legislature, and we've been working for the last 8 years working to get those bridges constructed. To date, we have 255 of those bridges that we have repaired or replaced, and we have 15 under construction. There's two significant bridges we have under construction that are still at the tail end because of their size of the program. One is the Sandy River Bridge project on I-84, and the other is the Willamette River Bridge on I-5 in Eugene. On the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene, we opened up one of the bridges to traffic a few months ago, and we've about half of the other detour structure has been torn down, and then we'll begin constructing the final structure, and that will likely be the final structure completed in the entire program when that gets completed. So we're just at the very tail ends of that program to be completed. Through this program, businesses and individuals have earned more than $936 million after taxes since this work has started in 2003. And finally, Connect Oregon. The Connect Oregon program, we've had four successive programs in Connect Oregon. The first three were $100 million, and the last one, the last session, was approved at the $40 million level. Just quickly moving through those, in Connect Oregon 1, 35 projects have been completed, three are still under construction. We have nearly $95 million of the $100 million have been expended. In the OTEA 2 program, we have 20 projects are completed, 10 are in the design and construction phase. Approximately $80 million of $100 million have been expended. In Connect Oregon 3, five projects have been completed, and the remaining 35 projects are in design and construction. Approximately $20 million of $100 million have been expended. The Connect Oregon 4 program, we have sent out requests for projects. The close date on that is actually on Monday, and so we expect to have, again, another very difficult choice in choosing between very good projects that are competing for those funds. We'll have a similar process that we use with our area commissions on transportation, our various modal and freight committees, and the Transportation Commission will be scheduled to be making that decision next spring, and then we'll work rapidly to get the agreements completed and those projects underway as soon as possible. So just a quick update, kind of the four major areas where we have projects that are underway. Any questions?
Do you want to take best bet to take questions now, or?
Let's take questions. Okay. On projects probably now, yeah. For me would probably be good.
Sounds good. Questions related to projects that have been covered. Representative Lindsay.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I last night, I didn't make it down here because it took me 2 hours to drive 15 miles. So my question was, I'm sitting up here, I might as well ask for it. How about 217? Can we get some help on 217?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, in fact, yesterday at our Transportation Commission, we had a project that we brought to them to add a project on 217 to help just with that. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I toured in Seattle some of the things that they're doing to manage their traffic and their speeds on their freeway system to get the maximum amount of capacity and safety in their system to eliminate incidences like you may have run into yesterday. And we have a project in development now to adjust speeds, to improve shoulder widths, and improve the safety to reduce the amount of accidents that we have and increase the reliability of traffic. It's not a silver bullet. It's not going to be the end-all to all capacity problems, but it's going to be a project we can do within the limited resources we have to maximize the amount of capacity and safety in that corridor.
Or, Representative Lindsay, you could move to a county that has a real interstate flowing through it. That's the other option, right, Representative?
I'll help, for once, Dave. I agree with Dave.
I'll help create a third lane, too, if you'd like. I'll go out there with a shovel.
Any other questions related to projects he's covered? I would just say, and obviously, I think you acknowledged right up front, you only covered just kind of a snapshot of a few projects. I know and you covered one of the projects in Clackamas County, but I've just heard with the Jug Handle project and the initial start of the Highway 212 additional lane right at the intersection of our districts, I've just heard nothing but good things in terms of the outreach that your folks are doing and the positive work in trying to accommodate. I've actually expected more complaints about the people complaining about construction-related delays and have not heard hardly any of that. I think it's going about as well as you can when you're doing work that's right in the middle of where people are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've worked hard to keep our mobility moving while we not only do our bridge projects but our JTA projects as a focus of the agency to keep traffic moving while we do these construction projects.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. Just real quick, last session we passed a bill because some of these projects were coming in under cost to where the money could return back to the general fund budget, I believe. I know on the project that's in my district, they're talking about not having enough money. So can we start steering the money to those projects? Because some are coming in under budget, some look like they might be over budget, and now we're steering it back to the general fund when we should be steering it to finish these projects.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Widener, these projects are gas tax funds, so they're not in the general fund. They're in the highway fund and in limited to the highway fund. These are also projects in Section 64, which are listed specifically in legislation. So if we were to move money, it would require legislation to move money from one project to another.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the underlying purpose, one of the underlying purposes for this was to not only create jobs, but to create economic benefit long-term for the state. So this is a question that must come up frequently, but how do we measure the return on these investments? And does ODOT have some sort of a means of... And if we can get Representative Lindsay, for example, down here more quickly, I'm not sure how valuable that is, but the question is, how would we measure that?
Valuable than a Harvard degree.
I mean, that's a challenge, I know, but I'm just curious. Yeah. How do we measure those? We can leave him out of this equation.
Chair Benz, we do track that with some of our projects in the OTO3 program and our bridge program. We measure the jobs that we produce with our various bridge projects. In the Connect Oregon, we request in the applications that they answer some of the questions that you have. But that's not a piece of data that we have for all our projects. For example, it wasn't part of the JTA requirements for the JTA projects. But we do have some anecdotal information, and we do have kind of case-by-case on different projects what we are able to capture from a job creation, not only in the construction of the project, but also what it supports locally to create jobs in it, like the example I use in the grant for the industrial park and for the airport.
Follow up. I guess each of the situations is going to be more or less difficult to measure, but some of these, there is no doubt in the world, they create an instant benefit. Mm-hmm. And it just seems that we would have some sort of means of measuring that. And And this is a bigger issue, I suppose, but maybe we just build it and figure, well, now things are better. And maybe that's as good as it gets, but that seems odd to me. In working out, this was slightly different, I know, in how we got to these projects than the normal course. And perhaps in the normal course, there's a measure of that. So one can weigh and balance which is going to return to us the most. Is that a correct statement?
Well, Chair Benz, how I would answer, most of these projects through our normal process, JTA would be different, but we move them through our area commissions on transportation, and our area commissions on transportation have local representatives that understand the connections between the economic development in their communities and transportation. And so when we look for projects that support community goals, not just transportation goals, and select those, our area commissions do usually a very good job, since they are county commissioners, mayors, local business owners, of understanding those connections. Now, whether we have specific metrics that measure the exact jobs and correlate those to the exact projects or the money we spent on transportation gets a little difficult, but I think our process we use with our area commissions on transportation support those goals that you're talking about.
Thank you.
Seeing no others, let's move on to Paul and Jerry. Whatever order you want to go in, then we're going to come back. Matt's going to back clean up.
Co-chairs Hunt, co-chairs Benz, members of the committee. I am Paul Anger. For the record, I am with Tevin Brothers Land and Timber Company in Rainier, Oregon. I'm also pleased to be the president of the Oregon Rail Users League. I'm here to talk about basically Connect Oregon and talk about our success story and what its impact is into rural Oregon. Tevin Brothers is a small little company. Started out basically cutting down trees and getting them to market. We've basically morphed into an intermodal company connecting highways and rail and to the marine highway system. That's the benefit of the photo in your packet. Basically shows our intermodal facility in Rainier, how it brings a lot of these things together. Connect Oregon 1, we were a small project, $400,000. If we could just add a couple more mooring dolphins, we could actually improve our connection to going to Hawaii. We would now offer the first opportunity for Oregon shippers to move straight to Hawaii. Everything else has to either move out of Tacoma, move out of Oakland, move out of Long Beach. These are for the big bulky commodities, the things that aren't sexy, 2x4s, rebar, manufactured pieces, things like that. In the $400,000 Connect Oregon project, we ended up adding 5 jobs to our company. 6 ocean carrier jobs came into our facility and 1 longshore shipped. 19 jobs created in a little town of 1,000 people. That's pretty big news for us. We came back again and asked for Connect Oregon 3 money, and that's mostly in the photo. If you take the bottom half of that picture and down there, that was all new work that we did in 2010. The marketing timing worked perfect for us. One, it was the timing to hit into the Asian log market, China and Japan and South Korea. Also a massive pickup going down into California. We now have added every 2-week ocean service to California. 57% of all the lumber going into Los Angeles, Long Beach, or Los Angeles County, Orange County, Riverside County, the Los Angeles Basin, comes through our facility. Every 4 weeks, all the lumber that goes into San Diego County for construction, raw construction, comes through our facility, coming out of the San Diego Mill. The project created another 40 jobs internal to us. Ocean Carrier added 3 jobs. ILWU added 16 jobs, basically. We had full-time shifts. On-site contractors added another 30 jobs. We added 70 jobs last year in a town of 1,000 people. What the benefit was just beyond just, gee, we got an opportunity to get some more work. 62 Oregon businesses ship through us. It's not just the timber guys, it's not just the lumber guys. The steel mills, the preformed steel going into the projects, paper mills, liner board mills. Again, big bulky commodities that are not flat screen TVs trying to get to a market. It's the big stuff that can take a few weeks to get to market. Steel, paper, there. The other one is some of the unique projects are there. If you're going to Disney, if you want to go to the new Disney resort over in Hawaii, All that came from Oregon Mills. It was preformed and pre-welded structural steel. It came through us. Some came in by truck, some came by rail, but it all left here going to Hawaii. All the new submarine degaussing facilities in Pearl Harbor came through here. Aloha Stadium rebuild, so when you see the Pro Bowl next year, all that came, Oregon Steel, that came through our facility. The NOAA Pacific Tsunami Warning System, and there's a list of other projects there. The other big project is Mexico's economy is booming. A lot of the lumber going for the Mexican, the Baja Peninsula, is coming through here, and construction equipment going up into the Bering Sea is coming through here. The benefit to the Oregon transportation system, again, is something bigger than just us. This year, we're moving to about 7,500 rail cars worth of logs. You get about 3.5 truckloads of logs to a rail car. That's 27,000 truck trips that didn't come up Interstate 5. They didn't come through the middle of Portland. They didn't go through the Terwilliger curves. They just came to market. Those logs move basically out of Eugene. Same with the lumber. The lumber's coming out of Saniam. We're doing about another 2,500 rail cars this year. Another 10,000 truckloads off the road. So collectively 37,000 truckloads that just didn't make it up there. Round trip trips, 74,000 trips. It's also new work for other people. The Albany and Eastern Railroad, they picked up new opportunities to get into market. So they can pick it up for Saniam. They hand it off to the Portland and Western Railroad. Jerry will talk about that. But we've picked up, again, these jobs. We're keeping all this stuff internal to Oregon. It moves. It's not just unique to Teven Brothers. Inside of our packet is a letter from the City of Prineville Railroad. And they are recipients of Connect Oregon 1, Connect Oregon 2, and Connect Oregon 3 recipients. They had multimodal improvements, basically the ability to start moving truck to rail or rail back into other rail back into the trucking industry and then be able to take off and box and put equipment together to go into the Class 1 railroads. Most rail warehousing and reloads. In 2004, they had 84 rail car movements. In 2011, nearly 900. To date, 207 permanent new positions created with another 245 jobs directly related to them. The Oregon International Port of Coos Bay, Mr. Calvary's here, inherited an abandoned rail line out to the South Coast. Thanks to Connect Oregon, their $4 million was leveraged to attract another $7.8 million of federal dollars. When those two came together, it brought up even more federal investment of another $16 million. And on October 11th this year, the line reopened and American Bridge and Reedsport is back up, basically bringing a bunch of phenomenal new jobs to there and shipping out some steel that I'm going to get a chance to handle at my facility up in Rainier. The lumber mills down in Brookings, Coquille, Coos Bay now have access to rail, and we're excited for that. That line comes in. For on the picture, the barge that is at the dock there, over a million board feet of that lumber came out of Brookings, Oregon, and had to come up. It had to be trucked the entire way. Hopefully soon that'll travel by rail. Why Connect Oregon? Some people kind of question, why is private industry getting in with this? In today's lending environment, it's tough out there. We've had line of credits disappear overnight. On the logging side, we have $1 million line of credit that went to $400,000. Our lenders just pulled it. Never late on a payment, never did it. We just took it away from you. It's hard to go out and get it at this time. There's also really no other real mechanism to support these projects because when you're going at risk, it's difficult for them to come forward. The impact on the Oregon Interstate Rail System, and this is one that Director Garrett's staff has done a wonderful job in the 2010 rail study. It talks about you could actually have a rail system that runs from the California border to the Columbia River, and it doesn't have to go out on the Class 1 rail lines. I know you're well-versed on the impact on the Class 1s because they're moving freight. They're hook-and-haul guys. They want to move this stuff across the country. They do a real good job on it. But they don't really have the ability to stop and pick up one rail car here and one rail car there. But the short lines do, and they do a darn good job of it. We now have this ability to move internal to the state, and it's a great opportunity for all of us. Impact to rural Oregon? Well, for in Columbia County, where I'm from, these are real jobs. But you can see just in Coos Bay or Curry County or Crook County, these are real meaningful jobs too. It's a big improvement to us. The other one is the opportunity for young people to actually have jobs to come back to. The other part is human investment, human capital. When people spend an hour and a half commuting somewhere, having to commute into the city, they don't have time to come back and serve on school boards or do other work, community involvement. This creates good jobs in the community. I ask you to continue with Connect Oregon because it's a great legacy investment. A wise person once pointed out to me, it's the roads in Italy that were built by the Romans in 700 BC that are still serving as part of the Autostrada today. This is that kind of investment. You're actually putting good stuff on the ground. You're putting investment in that's going to be our future. The other multiplier effect is it's not just the jobs during construction and the jobs afterwards, but the jobs for staying in Oregon, and it's creating more opportunity for Oregon businesses. And with that, I've probably rambled on enough. I thank you very much.
Great.
I don't have any questions, but I'll turn it over for Jerry if you want to make your comments.
Okay. Go ahead, Jerry, and then we'll come back to questions for both of you.
Very good. Co-Chairman Hunt, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Jerry Vest. I'm Vice President of Government Industry Affairs for Genesee in Wyoming. We are the proud owner and operator of the Portland Western and Willamette and Pacific Railroads, short line Class 3 freight railroads in the state of Oregon. Our presence in the state dates back to 1993. The company itself dates back to 1899, Genesee in Wyoming. But in Oregon, we've been here since 1993. We have 466 track miles in the state. In the packet of information, the last page in my documents that are in front of you, I believe, is a map of our network. We have 165 employees. We handle tens of thousands of freight cars every year. We basically run up and down the Willamette Valley from Eugene to Portland out towards Astoria. And we have other lines radiating off our main trunk line, our main north-south line, going to places like Toledo, Forest Grove, and Willamina. Paul, in his remarks, gave some great examples of specific Connect Oregon projects, what they are, what the benefits are, how they've improved the state and communities and freight customers in the state. What I'd like to touch on are really the unique situation freight railroads, both large and small in Oregon, are facing, how Connect Oregon plays a very important part in us providing efficient, safe, and support for industry and rail freight transportation. And what I have seen in my travels across the nation for states that have public-private partnerships that allow freight railroad participation, the great things that Connect Oregon has as a program. And I'd like to wrap up in a brief fashion with just some ideas about going forward. Freight railroading is unique. You all probably already understand that. The Association of American Railroads several years ago did a survey of the major railroads in the United States, and they found of their gross revenues, they reinvest 17.7% back into their physical plant. And at the same time, they surveyed other major industries like chemical, steelmaking, mining, automotive, and found the range much lower of gross revenues reinvested back into the physical plant in the ballpark of 3 to 5 to 8%. This really drives home how capital intensive freight railroads are. The other element that really makes us unique is the fact that we own or lease but have the full responsibility of ownership, maintenance, expansion of our right-of-way ourselves. Other modes of freight transportation, highway, water, air, that hold themselves out as common carriers, basically operate over a network that was built and maintained by the public entities, either federal or state governments or both. As short line railroads, we face even more challenges. Many of our lines in the Portland, Western, Willamette, and Pacific are great examples of lines that have been spun off by the large railroads because there was not at the time enough density, enough traffic on it for the large railroad to economically operate it. And just like if any of you all or myself were going to sell your home or sell your car, you're not going to rebuild the home or rebuild the car to sell it. These lines were often subjected to years of deferred maintenance. And that primarily reflects itself in our ability to handle a modern, fully loaded freight car that is typically handled on the large rail network. The typical modern freight car loaded with commodity, it maxes out at 286,000 pounds. Many short lines cannot handle that heavy of a car because of either typically the old rail or the bridge structures on the line. And so these elements are things that as short lines we're constantly working to invest in, to upgrade, so we can be a more seamless part of the rail freight network in the United States. How that ties on the Portland Western with Connect Oregon, a great example is our what we call the A line. It's our line that goes from basically Portland out towards Astoria. This line had old, obsolete rail on it, lightweight, that limited our ability to efficiently and in a normal manner handle heavy modern rail freight cars. Through a series of two Connect Oregon grants, Connect Oregon 2 and Connect Oregon 3, and a significant investment by our railroad, well beyond the match required in Connect Oregon, we have been able to upgrade the rail on this line and are capable now of efficiently handling these heavy freight cars. And this has opened up this entire corridor. It not only supports the 25 industries, the customers we serve on the line that employ about 1,000 workers, but it has opened up many sites along the line between Portland and the end of the upgraded rail at Port Westward for new development. The second topic I wanted to touch on very briefly, the real positive elements of Connect Oregon and how it's structured. It is truly impressive that it's so multimodal. This isn't just another way a state can just put more money in an interstate highway, with all due respect to ODOT, or fill potholes on a road. I mean, this is looking beyond the highway network, realizing that it's a fully integrated network of transportation we're dealing with. And Connect Oregon appreciates that. It really is thorough, the application process, very thorough. I think it gets to the point of what are we trying to really invest in, the public funds, and what public benefits are in it. But the application process is not overwhelming. Some states have fallen into the trap of making the application process so cumbersome that it just almost isn't worth it. The program has tremendous bipartisan support, and you know, looking at how this is unfolded, especially in the last year or so in Oregon, you all have done a great job of being able to maintain Connect Oregon and move on to Connect Oregon 4 in what has been truly unprecedented, financially trying times. And I compliment you all for that. And finally, you know, a lot of states, and I'm thinking of a few Midwest and East Coast ones, are overwhelmed by their metropolitan hub, and they become kind of a massive black hole of funding. You can never have enough. Oregon's not like that. You all have done a great job, I think, through the Connect Oregon selection process of having good geographic dispersion, recognizing that there's an urban need, but there's a lot of suburban and rural needs, too, and Connect Oregon does a great job with that. So, you know, this capital intensity of railroads really is something that we always have more projects than we have the ability to fund out of our own cash flows. And this is where this is so important, the Connect Oregon program. Going forward, my first recommendation or suggestion would be for us to try to find a long-term, sustainable and committed source of funding for Connect Oregon. Especially in railroading, asset life is very long. The new rail we're putting on the A line will last 80 or more years. Typical cross tie will last 20 to 25 to 30 years, depending upon how much traffic and its location on our line. So these are real long-term life assets, and it forces us to look long-term in terms of where we make our capital investments. So if there could be a continuation of Connect Oregon that we know about, that could actually become an advantage in long-term capital and infrastructure planning in the state. Second, I would encourage you very strongly never to lose sight that Connect Oregon should be for long-term infrastructure improvements, the type Paul talked about. Some states have fallen into the trap of taking programs like Connect Oregon and pushing them to maintenance. The typical type of maintenance on a railroad would be tie and ballast renewal. Or resurfacing the track, we call it. This type of work, we should be able to afford ourselves. And if we can't, we shouldn't be coming to the state asking for funding for it. Connect Oregon fills a great niche in terms of how can we improve the network, the rail freight network. And that's really tied to my third suggestion to you all, and that is any public-private partnership is successful if they're clearly defined public and clearly defined private benefits. And the public benefits logically would be supported with the public funding, the private benefits supported with, in our case, P&W funding. And keeping that balance, keeping that focus, there needs to be both, I think, is critical for long-term public-private partnership success. Finally, and it really should have probably been number one, are jobs. Industrial sector jobs are directly supported by Connect Oregon investments. Paul touched on that in the projects. We see it on the A-line and where we've made other Connect Oregon investments. Attached in your package is an article by Mr. Jack Roberts that was published in the Register Guard. It talks about the need for reauthorization of surface transportation at the federal level. The reason it's in your package is he does a great job talking about transportation infrastructure investments and the creation of jobs. And this is important, and we have high hopes for things like the A-line, that we will be part of the catalyst to bring new industry, new jobs to that region of the state. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions for Paul and Jerry before we go to Matt. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. There's no surprise that I'm a big proponent of rail and improving our rail system and increasing our capacity. My question for you two in particular, it's not necessarily your responsibility, but I would like your professional opinions. As the economy improves and we can we can see an increase in manufacturing, hope to see an increase in agricultural exports, where economic activity is increased generally, and we're exporting more. What can we do if we recognize that we don't have the capacity, whether it's short lines, but then joining on to main lines, we don't have the capacity to move all the freight and passenger trains that need to move in Oregon. When we read reports about still having a number of bridges that cause the travel time to be slowed by 10 or 15 minutes between Eugene and Salem, for example, because of certain bridge structures, when we read about the choke points in Portland, when we have hopes for adding a couple passenger trains, but those then are